Welcome to the Fishing Daily Podcast, sponsored this month by Saltwater Marketing, digital marketing services for the commercial marine industry. Here's your host, editor of the Fishing Daily, Oliver McBride.
Welcome back to the Fishing Daily Podcast. I'm joined today by Jerry Percy from the new Under 10 Fishermen's Association, and it'll soon become known as the National Non-Sector Organization, CIC. Welcome, Jerry.
Hi, Oliver. Glad to be here.
Jerry, just for people who don't know what your organization is about, could you tell us a little about the new Under 10s Fishermen's Association?
Certainly, yeah. So in briefly, really, I suppose it goes back to the 90s, really, because when the fishing opportunities, effectively FQA's quota, was sorted out in the late 90s, finally, by the government, the only people in the room were the large-scale interests who, unsurprisingly, then probably ended up with something around 98% of the national quota. And the under-10s were always sort of playing catch-up or the poor relation. And this was relatively ignored until 2005, when the UK government introduced something called the Registration of Buyers and Sellers, which for the first time required not the fishermen themselves, but the first sale buyers to record and report their landings that they purchased from under 10 metre boats. And all of a sudden, government threw up their hands and said, good Lord, under 10 metre boats catch finfish, and then slashed the quotas dramatically. And they weren't very good in the first place. So that was the rationale, the reason for creation of the new Under 10 Fishermen's Association, NUPFA, and that's what's been its main driving force for many years, up until quite recently, where I suppose the best way of saying, you know, if we were having this conversation 5 years ago, the vast majority of calls to this office would have been about not enough quota. Tragically, over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, that has moved from no quotas, no fish on the ground, and that is particularly worrying, and it seems to be getting worse by the minute.
Transition from the NUPFA to the National Non-Sector Organization, CIC, will it see any changes to the direction of the organization?
Well, the main rationale for the change from the NUPFA, New Under 10 Fishermen Association, to the National Non-Sector Organization is that myself and my fellow director, Sarah Reddy, who comes from a fishing family down in Brixham, over the period of the pandemic, to a certain extent before, but mainly during the pandemic, we found that we were getting just as many calls for advice and support from the over 10 metre non-sector fleet as we were from the under 10s. And this illustrated the fact that really they don't have an avenue of support, their words, not mine. And we were dealing as much with sort of welfare, mental health issues, finances, legal side of things, as we were with, if you like, the policy side of things with these people. And I didn't realise at the time how many, 35% of the over 10 metre fleet is non-sector, that is not in a producer organisation. So they don't operate in a club of quota, they have their own individual quota that they manage themselves. And because of that, we felt that there was three things needed doing, really. Firstly, to move NUPFA into a far more sort of broad-based organisation, at the request of fishermen, I hasten to add. And secondly, that we incorporate this sector, that we move it into a community interest company, which gives a far more inclusive approach with the fishermen for the organisation. And that we seek to try and represent all this sector across the board. And we've significantly changed the board of directors. So the new CIC has got, and I'm very pleased to say, a very strong board of directors to decide on our direction of travel. So my job won't change. I do it on a voluntary basis. And probably because fishermen are very reluctant to put their hand in their pocket very often, we'll probably continue to do so, as does Sarah. But we will need some support for, you know, on costs and travel and subsistence, etc. But generally speaking, we've got a great board now, including a very experienced working fisherman, someone from the supply chain side who also runs the CIC, which will be particularly useful. So I think probably that the the very significant change for the NNSO is that it will be all encompassing and with a very strong board of directors. So I still deal with policy. Sarah deals with all that legal, financial, welfare issues, as well as she's very, very strong on things like IVMS and the legal side. And because she's a qualified lawyer, she's been able to bring NUTFA or the NNSO into something called LawWorks, which is a group of barristers and solicitors who will provide pro bono work for fishery stuff for us or on our behalf, which is going to be, I think, massively important going forward.
This change, will it mean any change for your role within the organisation?
No, not really. No, I deal with policy issues. Sarah deals with everything else, bless her. So no, I think we'll continue. As I said, you know, we both do it on a voluntary basis at the moment, and I see that continuing really. There will be need to be some level of input from members to cover things like travel and subsistence. You have to be in the room at meetings, which is the reason that the under 10s have struggled for many years until the advent of NUTFA.
COVID and Brexit has had a big impact on fishing in England. How has that affected your membership?
Well, I think it's been well documented that both of those issues have had massive impacts on the inshore fleet. I mean, Brexit was really an unmitigated disaster from day one. You'll be well aware of the issues we had in terms of exports for people trying to sell mussels. They lost their market overnight, which was just a fundamental nonsense. In relation to Brexit, promised hundreds of thousands of tons more fish, independent coastal state, taking back control, and so on and so forth. In reality, the opposite has been the case. The UK government has licensed the best part of 2,000 European vessels to maintain their access to our waters, a lot of them up to the 6-mile limit, and we may talk about that later. We didn't really get any more fish. We've got a little bit more pelagic species, which I think may be a benefit. But if you look at the figures, and there was a recent report published by the New Economics Foundation, which is worth reading, because, you know, just the difference between Brexit promises and Brexit reality. As I said, I think you know, a lot of people say, well, the fishing industry voted for Brexit. A lot of them voted for Brexit, and they should live with that. But of course, you know, I think we went from sort of poster boy to patsy almost overnight, because obviously there was long ingrained dislike of the common fishery policy, which is in many ways is quite right. You know, it was we had some of the richest fishing grounds in Europe, and we became subject to equal access to a common resource. In fact, as did you guys in Ireland, and you know, we've all suffered because of it, and we continue to suffer because of the Trade and Cooperation Agreement. So I suppose in a nutshell, Brexit's been a disaster for us. The pandemic then, of course, compounded all that and had all, I should think, just the same impacts with the UK fisheries as it did probably across Europe and beyond, really. You know, obviously so much stuff closed down, especially for the inshore fleet, who provided a lot of fish to sort of local restaurants, high-end restaurants, London and so on and so forth. And of course, all the hospitality stuff closed down, and fishermen suddenly found they had no markets for their fish. I think some of the initiatives that were provided to try and support that were helpful, but so many fishermen, especially the smaller scale, who I've often said they may not show up on an economist spreadsheet, but they do nevertheless provide very significant social and economic benefits to their local communities. They, you know, they have families, they have mortgages, they have bills, etc. They pay. So I think that, and that really did added to which, of course, we had a couple of really awful winters for weather. So the whole lot was a complete disaster, and some of it is still ongoing now.
Do you think the government understands how important the inshore sector is?
Well, they say they do, Oliver. Why should I disbelieve them? I don't think they have really answered the baseline question of what do we want from and for our fishing industry, big or small. And I think they've tinkered at the edges. They've had a bit of a get out of jail free card for decades because of the common fishery policy. We could always blame Europe for failures, and quite rightly so. I mean, European fishery management was epitomised by the too little, too late approach to fisheries management. And it doesn't seem to have changed very much now. But I think they failed to really understand or decide. You know, they are the government, and they haven't decided, I think, what they want from and for it. So we are moving almost inexorably towards a very much smaller fleet of very large, powerful fishing vessels, many of which will be owned by foreign interests. Over 50% of UK quota now is in foreign hands. And at the same time as that is happening, so we'll be losing a great many smaller scale boats. It is, if I'm honest, frankly terrifying, the number of calls we get of fishermen giving up, struggling to make ends meet, trying to relocate to where there may be a bit more fish. And we have, I think, reached this existential crisis in the majority of certainly England and Wales and parts of even of Scotland, where, you know, we are seeing the demise of the inshore fleet and the rise of this, you know, cadre of very large and powerful and very often EU vessels. I think it's epitomised by this, you know, this change in the calls to this office from, you know, not having enough quota a few years ago to just not having enough fish on the grounds. And it comes back again to largely to the trade and cooperation agreement, which really tied our hands and has tied them for many years to come. It's allowed access to our waters, even up to the 6-mile limit for many European vessels. It's not all European vessels. You know, I do think we need to really consider the balance between large and small, large impacts, small impacts. And I'm not for a moment saying that all big is bad and all small is beautiful, but I don't think the balance is quite right there. I had calls 2 weeks ago from some of our boats on the south coast that had steamed out to fish just on the 6 or around the 6-mile line or just outside it, and were literally bullied off the ground by Dutch fly shooters who were shooting around them. And these are very big, powerful vessels. I mean, if there'd been any sort of gear conflict, you know, our boats would quite easily have been pulled over. It was noticeable that as soon as it became known that a fishery protection vessel had sailed from, I think, Portsmouth to come and see what was going on further up the coast, that there was this sort of mass exodus, a stampede of Dutch fly shooters back home. I got the AIS tracks on the computer, and it was probably no coincidence they all decided to disappear back to home en masse. But far be it from me to cast aspersions on them. But the serious point is, and I suppose it does beg the greater question about, you know, we have become very, very efficient at catching fish and catching fish in quantity. These fly shooters, they don't really bear any resemblance to what you'd consider traditional seining. They've got big, heavy gear, massively powerful boats, huge boats. They ostensibly focus on non-quota species, which again, most of our guys are largely reliant on, mainly because they don't have the quota for quota species. But they really are clearing the grounds, which was bad enough. And this happens both sides of the channel. You know, we're getting calls from English fishermen down the Channel coast and up the southern North Sea, and we get just as many calls through the Low Impact Fishers of Europe platform Life from French inshore fishermen who are suffering exactly the same. The general comments are, you know, that it's not worth going to sea for 3 or 4 days after these boats have been there because there's no fish left on the ground. And tragically, I think this is almost a rerun of the Dutch electric pulse fishing issue that we had here not many years ago, where we ran a very, very long campaign supported and largely taken over, thank God, because they had the resources to do so by people like Greenpeace and the Bloom Association, etc., powerful NGOs. And our combined efforts resulted in a ban on electric pulse fishing. And I think that's what we need to do. The problem we have is that our fishery minister, Victoria Prentice, has said that she hopes to get fishery management plans for non-quota species in place by 2023. But to be absolutely honest, I think 2023 is going to be too late for so many small-scale fishermen.
That was going to be my next question. Do you think by 2026 that the whatever government's going to be in power, do you think, would they renegotiate the access between the 6 and 12 miles for the European boats?
Oh, it's a very good question, Oliver. I mean, this was really one of our few absolute red lines in the Brexit negotiations. We made it abundantly clear to government and anybody else who would listen that, you know, this was a key, that if you wanted the survival of the inshore sector, then you had to have exclusive access, not just to North 6, which is common throughout Europe, but in fact also to the 6 to 12, because otherwise you end up, as we have, with effectively a curtain of mainly, but not exclusively, European fishing effort on the 6 and 12 mile line, and the fish don't get a chance to get through. It's as simple as that. So, and we were, I've got all the quotes written down from the minister, from Johnson, and from everyone else in power, that, oh, there's nothing to worry about. This is absolutely no argument at all. We're going to retain, or we're going to get exclusive access to the 6 to 12 mile line, because don't forget, we're going to take back control. We're going to become an independent coastal state, with the quotes. But the reality was that I think almost on Christmas Eve, it became clear that we had in fact not gained exclusive access to the 6 to 12, which I think, and I wasn't in the room, I don't know, and I can't prove it, but I do get the feeling that the negotiators who I was speaking to on a very regular basis were as surprised as I was that we were, that we didn't in fact claim this, because it was supposed to be a done deal. You know, we were going to get 6 to 12, no arguments at all. And whether it was a coincidence that this fell through when Boris Johnson had a phone call with von der Leyen, the European president, on Christmas Eve or just the day before, whatever it was, and all of a sudden, boom, out the window. And sorry, guys, you know, you're going to have a huge fleet of European vessels trundling up and down the 6 mile line, which, as you well know, then prevents our, certainly our passive gear guys, you know, pot fishermen, net fishermen, from putting any gear outside the 6 mile, because it just gets towed away. And it has been an unmitigated disaster. And I do think epitomizes the difference between the promises and the realities of Brexit.
Think the joint fishery statement will improve anything?
Ha! That's a $64,000 question, to be honest, Oliver. It all depends really on whether DEFRA and the government do what it says on the tin. So the joint fishery statement, for those people who don't know, is really a mechanism for putting the flesh on the bones of the Fisheries Act. So again, you know, we had common fishery policy, we had Brexit, EU exit, so we've got our own Fisheries Act 2020. And when I read it, I was going to say pleasantly surprised, but I was very surprised at the detail, the level of notably Section 1 and Section 25. So one of our big issues with the under 10s has been this sort of lack of quota, an ongoing lack of quota. We get access to, say, something around 2% of the national quota, which despite being 79% of the fleet by number is something of a nonsense. So Section 25 all of a sudden says, well, rather than just carry on using effectively only historic track records to allocate the resource, you know, what you caught last year. So for your listeners, I'll try and do it very briefly. In the 90s, the government said to the larger scale fleet, look, record your catches, record your landings over a 3-year period, and then we'll give you an average of those 3 years as your individual fixed quota allocations. And by their own admission, I have to say, the larger scale boats inflated their landings, which, you know, not entirely surprising. If I was being in that position at the time, I may have been tempted to do the same. So if you landed 15 tons, you'd write down 20 tons, because that way you get a greater historic track record and therefore greater benefits when it's all sorted out. And that's really what we've been faced with ever since. So, and it, you know, the annual allocation of fishing opportunities quota is against FQAs is based largely on, almost exclusively on what you had last year. The Fisheries Act, Section 25, says, no, hang on a minute, we're going to include, and governments must, it doesn't say shall or could or if you feel like it, must include social, economic and environmental criteria, which clearly benefits those who have social, economic or environmental issues and benefits. So that is going to be a very interesting development. and the way that DEFRA allocates access to fishing opportunities in 2023, I think, is going to be a key signal as just how committed they are to the Fisheries Act. And as I said earlier, at the same time, Section 1 has a range of 8, I think, objectives, sustainability, scientific, social. There's a lot of objectives there that really, what they're saying is that we really need to allocate access and resources and manage fisheries and protect stocks through these various objectives, including, interestingly, the precautionary objective, which the Act helpfully defines as, you know, you shouldn't hold up making decisions based on a lack of scientific data, you know, if you're going to be precautionary about things. So on the face of it, and apologies for answering your question in such a long-winded way, it will depend entirely on whether DEFRA actually do come through and follow their own act.
Question about the onshore fleet only having 2% of the quota, yet being 79% of the fleet. How do you think that would need to be balanced out?
Well, at the moment, it's a bit of a moot point, Oliver, because there's no fish to sort out, to be honest. And that, you know, I might take it lightly, but it's anything but a light subject. I think it is really, you have to rely, whatever I might think, I think you have to rely on what the law is. And the law says that allocation will be based on social, economic and environmental criteria. And the impact of fishing, and it's there to encourage selective fishing and so on and so forth. So it's not for me to answer that question. The question is answered because of the content of Section 25 of the Fisheries Act, and we'll take our chances along with everybody else that if the government do follow those rules, then it should be of a net benefit to the inshore fleet, because 80% of that fleet use passive gears. You know, they clearly don't have the environmental impact that large-scale heavy fishing vessels do. And they do, of course, generate significant social and economic benefits to their own local fishing communities. It begs the question that if the government is going to use social, environmental and economic criteria when allocating resource, then what social or economic benefits come to the UK from foreign vessels or foreign-owned vessels, albeit they might be flagged onto the UK register and hold UK fish fixed quota allocations? What benefits are there to this country from their efforts and impact? In my humble opinion, it's effectively almost zero. So what is going to be very interesting, and I'm sure a lot of lawyers will make a lot of money out of discussing it, is just what are they going to do about that? Because as I said earlier, over 50% of our quota is held by foreign interests. And if that quota or the allocation of fishing opportunities, it's a bit of a misnomer to use the word quota. It's about fixed quota allocations, your share of a national resource. So I think this is going to be a real conundrum for DEFRA, because obviously, you know, the holders of those FQAs, the fixed quota allocations, will scream blue murder, that they have a legitimate expectation to future allocation. When I use that phrase advisedly, because that was the phrase used by the larger producer organisations when we had a judicial review of the allocation of fishing opportunities back in 2013. And the High Court judge, it went to the High Court in London in the end, and the High Court judge said that you have no legitimate expectation to any future allocation. If DEFRA so choose, they could choose not to allocate access to quota through the FQA system in any given year. It is up to the government. So it's going to be an interesting 12 months, I think, Oliver.
More immediately for the inshore fleet, there is the five-year survey that's going to be that's been introduced, and all these small vessels are having to go through it. There's also the catch-up. And there is also the vessel monitoring systems, the AVMS. That's a lot of pressure for small-scale fishermen to be dealing with. What is your members talking about right now?
It is, as I said earlier, really, I think we are in a very, very precarious situation. So obviously, if there's not enough fish on the ground to make ends meet and pay your bills, you're going to go out of business. That's a basic rule of economics. But I think it's exacerbated for smaller scale fishermen and to an extent some others by that sort of cascade of legislation that we're being faced with. So you've got the Marine and Coast Guard Agency, who really took over small boat surveying from that run by the Sea Fish Industry Authority. And the litany of complaints has been almost deafening, really, just because it would appear that they are bringing sort of big boat surveying approaches to very small boats. And there's all sorts of, I won't bore you with the litany of complaints from fishermen about having to drastically alter the design, the build of a boat that's been fishing safely for 20 or 30 years to meet some new criteria, you know, having to block up scuppers and so on. It was just, you know, to have some defined freeboard on a vessel because that's what it says in the book rather than it says practically. So that's been a real and an ongoing nightmare for so many small guys who have to have their sort of five yearly surveys. We've got the inshore VMS, which I'm sorry to that, it's just become, it's gone from the sublime to the ridiculous. So for those of you who don't know, the government has decided that all under 12 meter vessels will have an inshore vessel monitoring system, a box of electronics that send a signal every 3 minutes that gives you your speed and position. And it's been just a farce, really, of I was going to say misinformation, but just no information. The communication system from the MMO, the Marine Management Organization, is really not fit for purpose. You know, we are very, very keen to work with the Marine Management Organization. They have new senior staff in place who are ostensibly equally as keen to work with, to re-engage with fishermen, to rebuild trust, in their words, etc. But they do seem to be shooting themselves in the foot. So Wales, for instance, the Welsh government decided they were going to have one IVMS supplier, and they would buy them and they would give them to fishermen, which is what they've done. The UK government, the Marine Management Organization, issued type approval to four systems, which you can then go and buy and claim the money back from the government, which has its own particular issues. Unfortunately, despite this type approval being carried out months ago, they only last week then suspended one of the four available units, which has put an any number of fishermen into a bit of a quandary. You know, I bought this kit, it's now suspended, what's going to happen? And we're still waiting for some detailed answers, which we're promised by the 9th of March. So I really do despair. You know, the fishermen have got enough on their plate, they've got enough mental health and worry and stress issues without this sort of nonsense going on. You know, just badly handled, it's immensely frustrating. There are question marks over how long these things are going to be reliable for. You know, I'm not naming names, but some of them that have been done on trial haven't really been as reliable as perhaps they could have been. And there are issues over, you know, they don't work close to cliffs, and you know that whether how accurate they are, whether they will be, that data will only be used on its own for enforcement purposes. We're told it won't be, it'll only be part of a wider one, but experience in the trials that have taken place would suggest otherwise, which is a particular concern, because, you know, I think the IVMS thing can be encapsulated as, you know, a little knowledge is a basic, is a dangerous thing. You know, you might be able to figure out the boat's position and speed and direction of travel, but that's about all. It doesn't tell you everything you need to know if you're going to sort of start thinking about enforcement. And there's a whole litany of issues around this, which I could run on to for some considerable time, but you'll be grateful to know I won't. But it is to an extent Big Brother. Fishermen are inherently against it. It's been handled very badly. And we are in almost constant dialogue with government, with the Marine Management Organization, and of course with fishermen over the issue. I mean, I think it's a done deal. We will have IVMS. I don't think we're going to escape it, but I think the introduction of it's a bit like the catch app, you know, the you may remember at the outset when they introduced the catch app into UK fisheries. It was just, you couldn't possibly have handled it more badly if you tried, including the leak of a consultant's report who slagged off inshore fishermen's feckless, criminal-minded, lazy cheats. You know, it really just, it was just a, compounded the problem. So we've got IVMS, we're talking, you know, to the MMO, but they really, really need to get their acts together, I think. The biggest failure, in brief, if there was a chance, excuse me, was that DEFRA didn't do an effective purchasing system. They had a look at, they did the fit for purpose trials, and they came up with these four. Incidentally, the Welsh unit, the unit the Welsh government had chosen, isn't one of the four that have been type approved by England, which seems somewhat perverse. But they've not followed a proper, you know, or fair procurement process. They promised they would, but they didn't. And where they tested the machines, but they didn't check to see whether the companies were viable, whether their warranties were fit for purpose, whether they were financially secure. And they've left thousands of fishermen to do their own checks before they decide on which unit to buy, which I think is grossly unfair. You know, so many fish, they haven't got the wherewithal, the kit or the knowledge you need to be able to pursue financial probity of these suppliers. I'm not for a moment suggesting there's anything wrong with them, but you know, anyone buying an expensive bit of kit would want to know that, you know, that they are good for what they're promising, etc. But DEFRA could and should have done that on behalf of fishermen rather than the thousands of fishermen to try and find out whether the things are right and the companies are right.
Are you concerned about the growing number of marine protected areas that's happening around the coastline?
Well, a bit like IVMS, Oliver, I think they're a done deal. You know, we're not going to escape marine protected areas. So I suppose the first thing to say that a surprising, in my view, number of fishermen are supportive of marine protected areas. I think they've seen the devastation caused on fishing grounds for some time, and they recognise, and it's their words again, not mine, it's not just the individual fishermen, a number of them said, look, unless the fish have got some areas of refuge to you know, relax, if you like, and to spawn, etc., then frankly, you know, it's the end of the line, to coin a phrase. I suppose our big issues from a small scale perspective is that, you know, with all due respect, if you've got a big boat and you're closed off from an area, you can afford and you have the ability to steam away to pastures new. If you're a small boat, you know, obviously limited in terms of tide and weather and range and so on and so forth, then you don't, you know, you don't have any option. So when they're talking about implementing or introducing marine protected areas, from our perspective, the big issue for us is going to be to ensure that they don't, I was going to say they don't displace us, but there's nowhere to displace us to. You can't just move up and down the coast to any extent. You are stuck with the fishing grounds that you've got. And to an extent, that's been a benefit because small scale guys have always tended to look after their local areas because, as I said, they have nowhere else to go. So I think for once the boot is on the other foot, where we have a very strong argument to ensure that marine protected areas, highly protected marine areas, marine conservation zones, special areas of conservation, the list is almost endless already, aren't imposed on inshore grounds to the extent that has a negative impact on our fishermen. As you've heard, a very long-winded way, we have all sorts of issues facing us, all sorts of challenges that some fishermen are just not, you know, not able anymore to cope with. The imposition of closed areas on inshore grounds, where I think would undoubtedly be the last nail in the coffin for so many.
Well, by 2026, do you think, will there be that many inshore fishermen left with everything that's happening at the moment?
No, I don't. And I don't say that lightly. There will be pockets. You know, the Southwest still seem to have quite a buoyant fishery down there, and some other parts of certainly England, Wales. None of what I say really is just my point of view. I must admit, I pride myself on reflecting the comments I have from fishermen around the country. I'm not putting words into their mouth. They're putting words into mine because they're the guys at the sharp end. And, you know, the from Fleetwood up to Solway Firth, you talk to fishermen there, there's nothing left for them there. Certainly the Eastern Channel is being decimated as we speak. risk by large-scale effort across the board of southern North Sea is much the same. I mean, I think pulse fishing had a huge impact on fish stocks. You know, obviously things like sole almost vanished. You know, you couldn't get rid of sole quota if you tried, apparently. And of course, it would have an effect on the actual benthos, the seabed itself, and that what lives in there. And increasingly, even up in the northeast coast there, you know, people are struggling for crab and lobster, you know, notwithstanding the mass mortalities we've had, which is just yet another nail, so to speak. But and it really is. I started fishing more years ago than I care to remember, but it's probably something around 40 something, 45, I don't know what it is. And off and on, I've been fishing and I've been representing fishermen and talking to fishermen, as well as various other roles. And I do honestly think, you know, it's always danger of trying to cry wolf, but I do think we've reached the end of the line in terms of where we can go. I really don't see, and certainly from the remarks I've had from fishermen, and fishermen themselves are just giving up. As I said earlier, we've lost 700 fishing jobs from 2019 to 2020. I get calls to this office every week from fishermen saying, oh, I've had enough, you know. And someone posed a question to me, I think only yesterday. I mean, I've had fishermen say, oh, bloody death row, I quote, and the government, they're just waiting for us all to die. We're all old anyway, and they'll just keep talking until we all fade away or go broke or sell up or whatever else. And I've always resisted that view. I'm always a believer in largely cock-up over conspiracy, but I don't know. I mean, it's the proof of the pudding is going to be in the eating, Oliver. I mean, I think if the government don't act and act now, we've been talking about things like, you know, limiting the impact of fly shooters and super trawlers for what seems like forever. Everyone knows there are solutions there. But my greatest fear is that by the time, if anything gets put into practice and we have any effective fishery management, bearing in mind that Boris Johnson promised us, I quote, world-leading fisheries management post-EU exit, then if we don't get this and get it today, then frankly, the game is over.
Well, 2022, is there anything that people should be looking out for that's coming up that would be important for the insured sector?
Well, joint fishery statement, or should I say the implementation of the joint fishery statement, bringing into being those objectives and articles that I mentioned previously in the Fisheries Act is going to be absolutely key. There's a consultation going on at the moment. Like all consultations, they seem to take forever, and then the outcome is never guaranteed. I think you can forget the trade and cooperation agreement. That's not going to be reviewed until 2026. And it's the same lot are in power. That won't get changed. I'm always surprised that for a government that was so keen on EU bashing and still is, you know, very plainly and frankly painfully in many respects, they seem to be running scared of the trade and cooperation agreement. And that, you know, it is there. We can do stuff as long as it's non-discriminatory to try and ensure the long-term survival, because this is not about favouritism. This is about a balanced approach to social and economic and to an extent environmental benefits, you know, that we had, as I said, right at the outset. I don't think they've decided really what they want from and for the fishing industry. And I think until they do that, and unless they actually implement the Fisheries Act, the Joint Fisheries Statement, then it's going to be just another too little too late. And of course, the ultimate irony of this is that this can be laid, the situation can be laid at the door of this government. They've been in power for nearly a dozen years. The last Tory Prime Minister that had an impact on fishing was, of course, Edward Heath, when he took us into Europe. And papers show very clearly they hadn't really given any thought to access to our waters and so on and so forth. And as history shows, they decided, I think, to quote, just to throw it into the pot. And that's resulted, obviously, in our waters in the UK and your waters in Ireland just being largely given over to other European nations who were much sharper when it came to the original negotiations and recognised the intrinsic and long-lasting benefits of a thriving indigenous fishing industry.
Well, thank you for joining us, Jeremy. It's been very interesting to have an insight into what's happening with the small-scale fleet under your membership. You will join us again, hopefully, to give us an update on what's happening.
Absolutely. More than happy to do so. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Oliver.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremy.